Welcome to Ron Paul and Charles Goyette, the weekly podcast. The World Bank says that China will soon supplant the United States as the world's largest economy. By any measure, China's economic growth has been impressive. Ours, not so much. For example, U.S. GDP growth in the first quarter of this year crawled in at just 0.1%. It's anemic. So, Dr. Paul, China's surge over the past generation tells us something about China's growth and its economy, but our own glacial pace tells us even more about what's happened in America, doesn't it?
Well, yes, and I think it's rather serious. First thing off, there's nothing perfect about the GDP. There are some flaws in it, the way the government measures it, and the whole principle. But the GDP, for instance, includes government spending. So inside this meager growth means that the government maybe spent money on weapons we didn't need. So that's a bit of an irony. But anyway, it's well accepted. The financial markets look at it. It does give us a hint on which way we're going. And it also gives us a chance to compare ourselves with China. It doesn't look good. Of course, one argument you can make is China's growing because it was so small and weak and the economy is, very, very regressive in the past. But now, all of a sudden, the total amount of the value of the Chinese market is greater. Just think about not that many years ago, Hong Kong had more wealth than all of China. It tells you something about just what a little bit of freedom does, and it's tremendous. But the big question is, of course, why is China doing so well and America is doing so poorly? Of course, some will say, well, it's because they have no environmental laws and that's it. And so they get away with that. There may be some truth to that, but I imagine there's more to it than that. I would think that somebody who really wants to evaluate it should look at our regulations in other areas versus what's in China. Who gets the most subsidies? Do we give more subsidies or do they give more subsidies? I know we have tremendous corporate subsidies. We were very generous in all our bailouts, and we've engendered a system that has produced, a great deal of our wealth going into lobbying and financing the politicians in Washington. Now, it may or may not be that way in China for various reasons, but we spend a lot of money just going into manipulating the tax code and the regulatory code. A lot of people who are very serious progressives who are concerned about protecting the consumer and all, and I say, well, you have these regulations on the bank to protect the consumer, but guess what? Guess who gets to write these regulations? It's usually, the special interest, and they protect themselves, and poor people still go bankrupt, and rich people do not go bankrupt. But we'd have to challenge our own welfare system, our spending, our deficits, our warfare, our excessive spending, fighting wars. And that is one place where we are dramatically different from China. We essentially spend about four times more than China does on the military, and they're a bigger country by population and size. But they work hard, they do make some money, but they save the money, then they invest the money. Where we're going and trying to take over the various countries of the world and control our oil supply in the Middle East and being involved in every area, they're investing their money. They actually talk to the Iranians and invest money in Iran, which makes pretty good sense if you are bending toward capitalism and away from authoritarianism. And I think, unfortunately, we're bending toward more authoritarianism. So if we continue this, of course, there will be a calamity. We will have a collapse. And one of the key features that holds it together is the U.S. dollar. We have a dollar that is seen as the reserve currency world. It's used more than anything else for all countries to use for international exchange and to hold as reserves. So we can borrow and pay off in inflated dollars. We can print the money and pay our debts. Tremendous advantage. And when the world trusts the dollar and accepts it, that's fine and dandy. We have this advantage way over what China has. Now, in spite of all that, China's getting ahead of us. And yet we bash China. There's a lot of China bashing by members of Congress because it's popular to do that and say, oh, China artificially lowers the value of their currency, and that gives them an edge on their exports, and that's terrible, and we have to demand that they have a free market in their currency. Well, that's the full-time job of the Federal Reserve, is to manipulate the currency and interfere in trade and to bail out their friends. It's the most interventionist system ever, and yet we have the nerve to bash the Chinese for having get involved in their currency and keeping it a little weaker. Actually, if you understood free markets and an understanding of money, there's no benefit to having a weak currency. Why should you or I say, well, you know, I have $5,000 in the bank. I'm looking forward to the government making sure that it's only worth $4,500 worth of purchasing power next year, and think it's an advantage. I mean, it doesn't. But their short vision says, well, if your currency is less valuable, that we might have greater exports, and this will help the people. Ultimately, though, that adjustment goes so quickly and prices rise and it doesn't even work. And yet we have been living with that kind of an argument for probably 100 years throughout the whole world. And it includes the communist world, as Russia, China, the old Soviet system in China, where they've accepted this whole notion of currency manipulation. So for us to be competitive again, I think we should do the very simple, clear things in moving toward a free market. And that is rein in the welfare system, rein in our military, get rid of the fiat currency, have a sound currency, encourage savings. Recognize that free market interest rates are the key to the message on how to invest money and who should save money and who should spend money. And yet it's all rigged. It's all rigged now. It's so crazy that they claim interest rates are 0%. And that doesn't work. Look at all they've done now for the past 6 years of rigging the interest rates more than ever, taking them down to zero and getting no growth. And now the Chinese have excessive growth over ours. And some people might argue that, what, doesn't China do the same thing and have the same problem? And there is some truth to that, because as we spend money in China, they take it and they turn it into yuan and they create yuan. So they have an artificial money supply too. And they will have malinvestments, so they will have some correction too. But I think in comparison, we have the greater correction to be made when a currency crisis hits. And because we have benefited beyond what we deserved, I think we're going to suffer a lot more than anybody anticipates. And the solution to this is actually just understanding how freedom works and how the markets work, and not thinking that, well, we could do better if we just, bash China a little bit more and keep criticizing them. But quite frankly, I don't think that's the answer.
Well, there's certainly a great deal of humor or irony implicit in the question of who are the real capitalists in the global economy this day. I mean, the first oil production deal signed after the fall of Saddam Hussein in Iraq was between Iraq and China. When Obama go to Africa, they're like Rockefellers passing out dimes, throwing away U.S. taxpayer money to buy the favoritism of chieftains and failed state leaders. China goes over there tying up real deals, real resources in real transactions that generate real profits.
Yeah, and you know, the other thing is another measurement of capitalism is who's running the bank. And as powerful as we are militarily, economically, and as strong as our dollar seems to be throughout the world, actually, the Chinese has us over a barrel. You know, if they really want us to bring us down, all they have to do is dump this $1.5 trillion that they're holding. It's not in their interest to do that. But if push comes to shove, let's say there's something gets out of hand with the Chinese and the Japanese, that's another problem that has to be considered, because they're fighting over some worthless rocks in the China Sea, the Shikoku Islands. And if that gets out of hand, then the big thing is what are we going to do? Are we going to get involved in that as well? So there's a lot. But I think basically China, if they had the motivation, if we get involved because we're involved with Japan. We have this so-called obligation because a previous generation signed a treaty, which I highly resent, that we will go to war, you know, for Japan anytime, any place, and we'll go to war anytime, any place over Taiwan. How can one generation promise to do that, with the use of the next generation? But if that comes and it happens, and people really lose their minds instead of pursuing economic transaction, that's when China could really, really show who's the banker. And I think, I'm afraid, they're in the driver's seat.
Dr. Paul, one of the things that you alluded to is the fact that the Chinese have been pretty good savers over the years, and Americans, not so much. Much of this can probably be attributed to social programs here in the United States, like Social Security, which impact the propensity of Americans to save for their own future. They don't have programs like this in China, and as a consequence, they save. The irony, of course, is that when Americans get ready to collect their Social Security that purportedly has been set aside for them, they will find that it's not there, while the Chinese at least have their savings.
Yes, but we have one other factor to consider. I think that's a big concern. It's not going to be there, but the nominal dollars might be there because if this system holds together for a while, we always can create dollars out of thin air like they have been doing. The purchasing power won't be there. The real wealth won't be there. So if you put away $100,000 over the years and think, oh, I can live on $100,000 for so many years, but what if that $100,000 buys $10,000 worth of goods and services? You've been wiped out. That is what we have to be concerned about. But it brings up the question about the incentive to save. Actually, our government and our Federal Reserve does everything conceivable to discourage saving. Matter of fact, guys like Paul Krugman actually brag about it. I don't want savings, he says, because if you spend the money, that's somebody else's income, and savings is ridiculous. So that means they have no concern. And the Federal Reserve Board chairman that I've asked this question to have always said, well, you know, it's a price to pay. And that is the price that if you do want to take care of yourself and you are saving money and you want your CD and you get less than 1%, that's criminal. That is theft. And it shouldn't be allowed. And we should get a market rate of interest. Just think, the market rate of interest could be 5%. And if you're a saver, that's a benefit. Well, if you had that money, wouldn't you be able to take care of yourself? Wouldn't you be able to spend that money at your time and your leisure when you want to? But this is one way to prevent the person from being independent of the government and forces you to be dependent on the government. But ultimately, the government can't deliver. And I think that's the message of the age, is governments are failing. They're failing, especially our government's failing in foreign policy, failing in protecting our civil liberties, and failing on economic policy. And the Keynesian model has been a total failure. It's about time we think seriously about its replacement.
Well, these government interventions always favor one party as against another that bears the expense of the intervention, and it is not a key to prosperity. Thank you, Dr. Paul, for another great conversation and podcast. And thank you for joining us for the weekly podcast. I'm Charles Goyette.